Hi, everybody. It's James Lilacs, and you know it's getting hot in this madcap presidential summer, but we're keeping it cool at Ricochet.com, where it's meaningful and civil, and you can join us for free at Ricochet.com/join. We'll give you a free month to get you started. And after that, a membership is just a few bucks a month, and it's money well spent to stay sane and sharp in this cycle. Ricochet.com/join to get your first 30 days for free.
From PowerlineBlog.com, this is Powerline with John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierengoff, and Stephen Hayward.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to the Powerline Show. It's Steve Hayward going rogue once again with a solo podcast. I thought we ought to because we're just a couple of days out from the Republican convention in Cleveland, and the latest news is that the Dump Trump movement has been routed in the Rules Committee. And it appears that Indiana Governor Mike Pence is going to be Trump's vice presidential nominee. It's a safe move on Trump's part. It means he's not going to double down on Trumpismo with Newt Gingrich or Chris Christie or perhaps General Flynn. Today, I break it all down with Henry Olson of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, who I caught up with in Washington, D.C. this week. Henry follows voting patterns and survey data with a keen eye. His batting average in his biennial pre-election state-by-state forecasts is usually much better than Nate Silver and the other pepsologists. And yes, I did contrive this entire podcast just so I could say pepsologist. It's one of my favorite geeky words. In any case, here's Henry. Henry Olson, welcome to Powerline. Let's begin with the obvious topic. We're talking a few days before the Republican convention opens in Cleveland. It doesn't look to me now like there's any chance at all that Trump will be derailed from the nomination, is there? Is there any probability left at all?
Yeah, I would say 1 or 2%. The key vote is going to be today, Thursday. If 25% of the Rules Committee chooses to unleash the delegates, then they have the right for an up or down vote on the convention floor on Monday. And then they can see whether or not there's a majority of delegates. But it's a pretty slim chance that a quarter of the Rules Committee is going to vote to upend the voters' decision and turn the convention into a free-for-all.
Well, aside from the mechanics and all the inside baseball of it, it seemed to me that what would really drive it was not those openings, but Trump doing very poorly in the polls. And suddenly we have these polls out from good outfits like Quinnipiac showing Trump ahead in some key states and very, very close to Hillary Clinton. And what do you make of those polls? And how do you size us up right now? It surprised me, I think.
Yeah, well, it surprised me a little bit. But what's notable is it's not that Trump is going up. It's that Hillary is going down. So I think this is a reaction to the Comey report that even though she's not going to be indicted, it's clear that despite her protests, she was at best ridiculously negligent and careless with treatment of classified material. He was very clear about that. And while Republicans are upset that there's no indictment, the fact is he might have delivered a very serious political blow under the waterline. And you're stuck with a case where now Clinton's negatives are almost as high as Trump's. And in that world, with two people who are strongly disliked, but you have to elect one of them, Trump victory looks more plausible.
Do you think there's any possibility for Gary Johnson and Bill Weld to get any traction?
Traction, yes. Victory, no. Traction meaning can they get in the 10 to 20% range? Absolutely. There's already a number of polls that suggest that. I think if they were to get some super PAC financing to actually run an air campaign, in which a libertarian hasn't done since the 1980 campaign funded by David Koch,
right.
It's entirely possible that they could capitalize on that discontent. But the fact is there's still at least a third of Americans who like each of these candidates, Trump and Clinton. There's at least a third of these candidates. They're not going to get below a third of the vote.
Right.
And it's implausible that Johnson Weld would get every single other voter to go behind them when there's so little flexibility that they have in their platform.
Now, I think I've seen some data showing Johnson Weld might actually pull more votes from Hillary than from Trump, which might tip some states to Trump, mightn't it? Have you looked at that and broken it down at any places?
Yeah, I think the data are still too uncertain. We don't have enough polls in some of these states to be sure. But there are some data that suggest Johnson Weld would pull more from Hillary in some places. Nationally, when those polls have been taken, they've tended to pull more from Trump, but Jill Stein still gets 4 or 5% of the vote, and she definitely pulls more from Hillary. So on balance, Hillary loses more to the combined third-party effort than Trump loses to the combined third-party effort.
Right, which it seemed to me just off the top of my head, and I don't follow it as closely as you do, but that would mean Colorado possibly becomes a Trump state. New Mexico, maybe? I mean, Johnson's home state, right?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is, yes, Johnson will pull more from the sort of soft Obama voter in those states, but there's also the soft Romney voter who is likelier to be willing to switch parties. Certainly the last poll that came out in Colorado that I saw had Clinton up by 7, right, which is only 2 points more than Obama's margin, but in the direction one would expect, given the high Hispanic percentage, the low religious conservative percentage of the overall electorate.
Right. The last time we spoke about this, which was a couple months ago now, I think, you were fairly firm at that time in your judgment that Hillary would beat Trump, because although Trump is attracting some voters who either haven't voted or haven't voted Republican, that he was losing more from other groups. Is that still your judgment, or is this or have you revised it in some way?
I'm slightly less confident of that in light of what's happened in the last week and a half. But again, it's not that Trump is going up. It's that right, Hillary is going down. For Trump, in order to win, he really needs to be in the 42, 43, 44% range. And he hasn't consistently done that in either national polls or in many of the state polls. So he's got a challenge ahead of him, and we'll see whether or not he can meet it in the next 60 days.
Right. Let's talk about something else that may be happening or coming back in this cycle, and it may be the return of ticket splitting. You know, the last 15, 20 years, you've seen the parties as they've supposedly polarized to become more ideologically coherent. The old phenomenon of ticket splitting disappeared, but I've seen some evidence, and I'm sure you know more of what's out there, that we may see ticket splitting again. You've seen certain states where endangered Republican senators are doing decently. You know, Toomey in Pennsylvania, Portman in Ohio, Ayotte in New Hampshire, in states that you think that Hillary Clinton may well win. So first of all, do you think it's coming back, and do you think there's a plausible rationale for many Republican candidates, if it looks like Hillary's going to win, to use the argument, you need to vote for me as a check against her? And do you think that would work?
Yeah, there's a few questions there. Let me unpack them.
Yeah.
Ticket splitting coming back. I don't see ticket splitting coming back in the traditional variety, which is to say a vote for one top of the ticket major party candidate and a vote for minor candidates on the other party ticket. What I'm seeing right now is people who are not going to vote for one of the major candidates who will then vote for a major party candidate below ballot. So you'll have people not voting for Hillary and Portman, but you'll have people voting for Gary Johnson and Portman, or you'll have people voting for Jill Stein. So it's a form of ticket splitting, but it's not the major type of ticket splitting that we've seen in traditionally the 1960 through 1996 period. Yes, I do think that there is room for congressional candidates and senatorial candidates, if it looks like Hillary's going to win, to use the 1996 Republican argument when it looked like Bill Clinton was going to win. Vote for us. Don't give her complete power. Is it going to work? A lot of that's going to depend on circumstances in October. The partisan trend remains very high. It's not like 1996, where you had a lot of people who still did think of themselves as Democrats or independents who were willing to support Clinton but were not wholly enamored of the Democratic Party. I think if you're talking about a Hillary winning scenario where that would be plausible, then you're talking about a Hillary who's polling 45, 46, 47% in these states. And then I think it would be – they might use it, but I don't think it is as likely to be as determinative, because if you're voting for Hillary for president, I think you're highly unlikely to be voting for a Republican down ballot to stop her.
Now, I know you always do a deep dive into the data and give your predictions a day or two before the election, and they're, you know, your percentage, your batting average is very, very high. And so it's early yet, but do you have a sense of how you think the Senate overall is going to go? Republicans going to keep it, do you think? Or have you tried yet to scope that out?
I'm regularly looking at it. House races break late. They come online in October. Senate races break a little earlier than that, and certainly there are individual circumstances that can still come into play. For example, Evan Bayh getting into the race in Indiana. If you'd asked me a week ago, Indiana was a safe Republican pickup. Today, it's a toss-up at best. But if Hillary Clinton is going to win, and if she's going to win with a percentage of the vote in the mid-40s, I think it's highly likely that the Democrats take the Senate by either getting the four seats that they need to break a tie with the vice president or the five seats they need to control outright. If she wins, but it's a record protest vote where it's 40-40 and 20% is split between Johnson, Stein, and others, well, then I could see the Republicans holding the Senate because it'll be no affirmative endorsement of her, but a rejection of Trump, if that's if that's where it goes. And that could mean a circumstance where this put a check on her would carry through some marginal Republicans in states that she would carry, but with low percentages of the vote.
So in other words, here in mid-July, you have no idea. Not really no idea. It's anybody's guess. That's a better way to put
Look, if you told me, go to Vegas and put your money down, I'd be very confident in putting my money down for Democratic control. I'm not so confident that I'll make the trip now.
Let me try a couple of propositions on you just to get reaction. One is that we know that some of the difficulty Republican Party has in presidential elections is some hangover from George W. Bush. You know, the Iraq War just went badly, and it's
defeat and depression are usually not winning tickets.
Exactly. And so the great fear that I would have about President Trump, if we get him, is that he might. Other people think he might be a disaster. He might be good. Who knows if he wins? I think we can't tell. But it's very high risk, it seems to me, because what happens to the Republican Party as a national presidential brand if you have another Republican president thought to be a disaster by the voters?
Well, the Republican Party needs to undergo a period of rethink, regardless of whether it wins or loses. Donald Trump is delivering a supersized dose of rethink in the form of his candidacy. The various elites in the Republican Party are largely rejecting that in various ways, whether through passive-aggressive embrace of him or through a rejection of him. But nevertheless, you can't deny what happened in the primaries, and eventually a rethink will go through. If there were a second disaster, it would simply force the party to reform much more dramatically than it might want to. It would certainly have the repercussion of probably a loss or two afterwards, because it takes time for parties to reform and regain trust. After the disaster of Herbert Hoover, it took the Republican Party 20 years before it could retake the presidency, and then only do so under the guise of a war hero whose stature basically protected the party from the sort of rethink that it had been trying to do unsuccessfully in the previous two elections. So a second disaster would almost certainly cost the Republicans the presidency for a term or two afterwards, and whether they could recapture it after that depends on large scale where the party goes.
Well, now I can give a equally or maybe even more plausible scenario in my mind of a disastrous Hillary Clinton presidency. But I want to put it in this context and let you take it whatever direction you want with which either party you want. One of the pieces of data that I think is the most compelling, I guess, is, and I know you know it, it's the survey that Pew and other people put together of public confidence in the federal government over the last 60, so some odd years, right? Used to be 72-73% of Americans in 1961 said they have confidence most of the time or all the time in the federal government. That has been a all downhill slide since then, with the exception of a bump up during Reagan, interestingly. But now that number's down in the teens, right? Or the other set of data that they report is the number of people who are angry or deeply frustrated with the federal government. And that's, I think, a combined 82%. It's the inverse of the confidence question. And that represents to me a fundamental problem for both parties. So I guess maybe the first question, or you can talk any way you want about that, but I'd ask this question. Are there different sources of the frustration between the two parties? And And what are the sources of frustration that Republicans need to pay attention to and address if they want to succeed?
Yeah. No, I think one of the problems with a question like that is it throws every sort of frustration together into one choice. I think you see some of that with the disconnect between the right track, wrong track question, where over two-thirds of Americans say that the country's headed in the wrong direction, but half of Americans approve of President Obama's tenure in office.
Right.
You know, the way you square that is to recognize that there are different reasons for the discontent. And some of them are Republican reasons, and some of them are non-ideological reasons, and some of them are Democratic reasons for people who would like to see the country move faster in a more liberal leftist tradition, that they could say they're generally satisfied with President Obama because he's still on their team, but would they prefer to see the country moving in a more expansion of government direction? Heck yes, they would. So for the Republicans, the temptation is to say that when somebody is dissatisfied with the federal government, it means that they disapprove of federal government action, to immediately translate that into a yes. Well, now that they're dissatisfied with the federal government, it means that they are ready to embrace the repeal of the Great Society and the repeal of the New Deal and a return to the pre-1932 Constitution. And Republicans rarely express that, but I think if you stuck truth serum inside of a lot of people, they would tell you that that's actually what they do believe. And there's no evidence for that. The dissatisfaction, and I think what Republicans have misunderstood is that the Republican victories over the last 20 or 30 years have not been a desire to repeal the New Deal, but the desire to enforce it, in the sense that what people understood the promise of Franklin Roosevelt to be was that they would be given what Roosevelt told them it would be, which is not the remaking of American life, but the rebuilding of American life, that they would have freedom to guide their own lives, but a little more security than a pure libertarian market would provide. And Americans want that still. So they see that in Trump, that Trump is somebody who is saying, I'm going to squarely put the problem with American life is that you no longer have the government on your side against the people who are putting obstacles in your way. I'm going to squarely put it on your side again. And his voters don't think either major party believe that, and they believe that only he does. And a Republican who wants to rebuild the presidency needs to understand that that form of dissatisfaction exists between the two ideologies, and it's that form of dissatisfaction that needs to be co-opted into the conservative side if you're going to have a consistent conservative majority.
Let's switch gears here and jump across the pond, since I know you follow British politics nearly as intensely as American politics. So, Brexit, were you surprised at the outcome?
Not on election night. I had a model that was...
Of course you did.
Of course I did. Yes. I had a model that I could go into each constituency as they came in, each local government constituency.
Right. I watched your Twitter feed on election night, and you were pretty telegraphing, this is how it's going to go based on what – anyway, keep going.
Right, yeah. So on election night, it was very clear very early that it was going to be a 2-4 point leave win.
Right.
And that leave did, in fact, win by 4. I was slightly surprised, although I did finally come down inside of calling a leave victory the morning of, because it was unclear to me how the uncertainty factor would play into it. Typically in a referendum, if you're not already yes, you're going to end up voting no. And that's what happened in the Scottish referendum.
Right.
But that's not what happened here. It's more reminiscent of what happened with Proposition 13 in California.
Exactly.
Where voter anger was suppressed.
Right.
In the voting booth, it came out in an explosion. So the uncertainty factor with Prop 13 was a heck yes, so that the margin of victory was much larger.
Right.
And the turnout was much larger than expected. And that's, in fact, what happened with Lee.
Right. You know, I was I wasn't doing it the way you were. I was sitting at dinner in San Francisco as the vote was starting to come in with Oliver Morton from The Economist magazine, who'd confidently predicted to me the night before that Remain would win. And he's looking at his smartphone, of course, and his eyes are getting big, and he's just turning pale because he couldn't believe what was happening. He was in a state of shock.
I think that's one of the problems worldwide, is that there is a group of people who are relatively insulated from the effects of the system that they've put in motion. When I talk with Germans who are from well-educated upper-income backgrounds. They sound very much like the Swedes that I talked to from those backgrounds, like the Americans. You know, there is this highly educated, six-figure earning person for whom globalization and modern social liberalism are unqualified benefits. And they simply have no idea that anyone else could be negatively affected by it, or that anyone else could be so angry at what's happening that they would reject their leadership. So your friend happens to be one of them.
Right. I know the British political system. On the other hand, I had never heard of Theresa May 3 weeks ago, and now she's prime minister. Maybe you knew who she was. I don't know.
Yes, I did. And she was somebody who had been tapped as by Conservative Home as the person to watch beforehand because she was cautiously remaining in a position where she could unify both sides, that she was not as out in front. She was a Remain candidate, but she was not out in front in the way that, say, Osborne was or some of the other people. And she had conducted herself quite well as Home Secretary, which in the British means that she was in charge of law and order.
Right. You know, there's an old sketch or old scene from the old Yes Minister series from 30-some years ago. They're discussing women in the civil service, and now it's quite ironic. One of them says, well, you couldn't possibly have any women in the senior ranks of the Home Office, right? Now you have someone who was the Home Secretary becoming the Prime Minister. Say a little more about her, if you can. I mean, of course, the media is already going to the trope that maybe she's a second Margaret Thatcher because she's a Tory. And I have no idea what to make of her. Do you have a sense of her that way?
Her initial speeches are, to my ear, quite welcoming. The trend, you need to put it into a little bit of perspective. So the Tories had lost three elections in a row, and they elected David Cameron. David Cameron's argument was, we need to modernize the Tory brand. Where have we heard that before? You know, and his argument was not dissimilar to what the elites in the Republican Party argument has been, which is, we need to reach out to minorities, we need to reach out to women, we need to abandon our conservatism on social issues. Basically, what we need to do is get back people who are highly educated and make a fair amount of money who don't think we care. And he proceeded to do that, and the electoral success was only forthcoming not because his share of the vote went up a whole lot, but because his opponents were divided dramatically. He was able to win re-election this time, again, not because his share of the vote went up a whole lot, but because his opponents were divided even more dramatically, and Labour had moved so far to the left that they were unacceptable to the British center. But you know, you go through 10 years of modernization, and in fact, you found that even dramatically changing the Tory party, what he had done is drive a fair number of conservatives out to a third party, UKIP, and not attract a whole lot of people in the center of his socioeconomic background. So against the drop of that, you have Theresa May. And the argument that I had been making for Americans and that my friend Tim Montgomery has been making for longer in Britain is that the way forward is actually not to pay attention to the people who would like to vote green or are seduced by the center-left after leaving university, but to focus on the working class, that they are the natural constituency. And to that end, what Theresa May's initial speeches are saying, I will not work for the privileged few, I will not work for the 1%, I will work for you. There are too many people in Westminster who don't understand the difficulties that you have, I will. And I find that a very comforting approach. Now, there's some things that she says along with that I don't find as comforting. Like she wants to have an industrial strategy, which immediately brings to mind Harold Wilson in the 1960s. But you know, the fact is the votes that are there for the right worldwide are the votes that are being detached on the working class from the center-left. And the party that recognizes that, or the movement that recognizes that, is the movement that can put a stake in the heart of the left in their country. And Theresa May, in that sense, is a second Margaret Thatcher. Not the ideological free market sense, but in that sense, because Margaret Thatcher's ability to win rested on her ability to detach what was called Essex Man, which was their version of the Reagan Democrat, the working class person who had voted Labour all of their life but was upset about the turn that Labour had had and attached them to the Tory party. When John Major lost those voters in 1997, he lost the majority. Theresa May aims to bring them back, and if she's successful in bringing them back, then the Tories will rule Britain for the next 20 years,
right.
Half of them under her premiership and half of them presumably under Boris Johnson's.
Yeah. One last question about this, and we'll draw to a close. I'm not following this hour by hour, but she's made Boris Johnson the foreign secretary, and mm-hmm. It looks like she's assembling a somewhat conservative cabinet. Is she keeping Osborne, by the way?
No. Osborne was sacked this morning.
Okay. You are ahead of these things. But otherwise, it looks like Boris Johnson certainly is a provocative pick, or certainly a solid pick from a certain point of view, right?
Yeah. Well, Boris Johnson was the lead public face of the Leave campaign.
Right.
He is the one Tory politician who has demonstrated, as in his two races as mayor of London, the ability to combine the traditional Tory vote with the UKIP vote. That David Cameron could not do it. Theresa May is going to try to do it. But Boris Johnson did it. That's how he won his elections two times in a row. I think what she's doing is putting notable Brexiteers in charge of all of the different positions. The three most notable conservatives of the right who she's placed are the foreign secretary, the new ministry for the negotiation of Brexit. David Davis has that. And Liam Fox, the conservative former defense minister, has been brought back into a new international trade.
Oh.
So basically what she's done is bring in the Brexit community and give them responsibility across the three portfolios for negotiating it.
Right.
So if they succeed, then she unifies her party. And if they fail, then she's got somebody to blame.
Right.
Because she's given the three key portfolios to the people who were taking the position that she didn't take.
Right. So that's very clever of her, maybe. Right?
And I think it's an indication that we're dealing with a very canny operator.
Yeah. Did she name a new chancellor today?
Yes, Philip Hammond, the defense minister was the foreign minister was moved over to the chancellor.
Okay. What do we know about him? Anything?
Steady as he goes, guy. Okay. He was in the Remain camp, but not a huge personality in that.
Okay.
She's brought in, as of a couple hours ago, a couple of women. She's booted Michael Gove.
He was education secretary?
He was education secretary during the first Cameron term. He was justice secretary. Stabbed Boris Johnson in the back, and she's never cared for Michael. Clearly, the fact that she brought Boris in meant that Michael was going to go out. So Gove's firing and Oliver Letwin's firing, a close Cameron associate, and George Osborne's firing all suggest a cleaning of the House. There was one Twitter that says that at the rate she's going, she will have sacked more ministers in her first 6 hours than Cameron in his first 6 years.
On that note, Henry Olson, thanks very much for joining us on Powerline.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Powerline is a production of PowerlineBlog.com. John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierendorf, Stephen Hayward, Joseph Malchow, and produced by Madison McQueen in association with Ricochet.com.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.